Accession number 27183, reel number 1.
Major Neave, reel 1. Can you tell me if there was a family background of military service?
Oh, very much so. My father was a regular in the Essex Regiment, and so far as the 13th, 18th Hussars goes, my mother's brother, Charles Miller, who eventually became Major General, he commanded the 13th, 18th before the war. And then my brother was on the supplementary reserve of the 13th, 18th. And the reason I joined them was because I was in an anti-aircraft unit at the outbreak of war, and didn't fancy serving there all the time. And under an obscure King's regulation, I gathered that a brother could claim a brother to serve with him under active service. And I joined the 17th, 18th on that arrangement. But it meant resigning my territorial commission, which I regretted very much. But it was the only way of doing it, and accepting an emergency commission, which had various side effects which were not entirely favourable to me.
What were those?
Well, I never qualified for the TD, for example. Not that that was anything of very great significance, although I think TD is a very splendid decoration to have. Not much otherwise, but there were features of having a territorial commission which were quite different to having an emergency commission.
Did it affect seniority?
It did affect seniority, yes. I lost about 2 years or so of seniority. I don't know why they did it that way. I would have thought it would have been perfectly easy to just transfer one from one time of commission to another. But anyway, I mean, they're really quite irrelevant. And then I had a cousin who joined the regiment after I'd left, and after my brother had left too. And now, interestingly enough, only this week I've heard of my grandson, who has been interviewed by the colonel of the new regiment, the Light Dragoons, which has absorbed the 13th, 18th, with a view to his becoming having a gap year commission, which would be rather splendid to have, making three generations of them.
Did you ever consider taking a regular commission?
No. I had a job in the city before I joined up, and that, again, was a family, had a family background, and I'd always said I'd go back to it, and tempted though I was, for the very pleasant life it was in the army, I always said I'd go back, and I did.
Did you do any military training or pre-military training when you were at school?
Yes. I mean, I was at Sherborne, where I was in the OTC, and got my Certificate A, and there's possibly a story of some interest to tell you that here in this house, which at that time belonged to my uncle, because my father was a younger brother of This house had been bought by my grandfather, and it was inherited in his death by my father's elder brother. He was the father of Aaron Eve, the MP who was assassinated by the IRA in the House of Commons. Well, he and I, Ari and I, were here in this house at the time when Anthony Eden announced that he was doubling the territorial army. And Ari, in a somewhat impulsive way, I suppose, said, come on, let's go and join up at the nearest territorial drill hall. And so we got in his car and we drove down to the village in Frowning Lane. There was a drill hall. We had no idea what kind of army it was. And we went in there and said, we have just listened to the Minister of War announcing the doubling of the territorial army and calling for recruits. And here we are. And they said, we're very pleased to see you both. Would you like to be officers or soldiers?
There was a free choice.
And we said, well, given the choice, we might as well be officers. And so we both signed on a pink form instead of a blue form or whatever it was. It wasn't quite so silly as that, because we did both have Certificate A, which I think meant that you were officer trained or supposed to be. And that I never did a day in the ranks other than at school in the OTC.
Had the OTC prepared you adequately to be an officer?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Certificate A was quite a thing to take, and it was a serious little exam. But no, I mean, I think one had other training for that. At any rate, we found ourselves officers in a searchlight unit. I mean, it took me about, I think, rather longer than it took my cousin Ari to get out. He joined the gunners and found himself in France with the expeditionary force, where he was taken prisoner.
He went to Calais, didn't he?
He went to Calais, and he wrote a book about it.
Flames Over Calais.
Yes. And in my case, this process of being claimed by my brother took rather longer, and I didn't actually join the regiment until I think the day after they got back from Dunkirk, which my brother had been with them at Dunkirk. And so that's how I came to be in the 13th, 18th, and how the family had got quite a few connections with it.
Did you see any action with the searchlight unit?
Oh, we did, yes, down on the Essex marshes. I remember very well one night hearing an aeroplane come in. We picked it up in the search. It was a seaplane, but it landed on the Blackwater River, the other side of the sea wall, and we couldn't deflect the searchlight over the sea wall, and there were German seaplanes laying mines in the estuary.
This was the river going up to Malden.
And there was nothing that we could do about it. We had an old Lewis gun, but you couldn't see the thing because it was in the dark, because you couldn't get the searchlight down
depressed
on the ground. It was meant to be up in the air for the...
Did anyone think of aiming the Lewis gun by ear?
By ear? No, I don't think they did. I think they were too frightened of shooting up the local farmer or something if they did that. But we saw quite a lot of action, and we saw several planes being shot down. Mainly, it was the idea is that you got the cluster of searchlights onto the plane that was coming in, and the fighters, night fighters, would then go and shoot it down.
Was there ever any idea that by using searchlights you could blind the enemy aircrew? Was that
I think that was, but they weren't usually of that sort of height. The seaplane was quite exceptional, I think, that coming in and doing that. It was pretty hazardous for them, I should imagine. If they had to land on the water in the dark, that can't have been easier.
Now, when you've been growing up, when you were at school at Sherborne doing your OTC training and so forth, there were some dramatic events going on in Europe and the rest of the world. Can you remember if there was a time when you first thought that a war was a possibility or a probability?
Yes, well, I think it had been the idea that I should go to university, which I never did, because of the impending war, which everybody seemed to think was inevitable. Indeed, there had been a thought that I might go to Heidelberg University, which would have been an interesting experience. But all that was put aside because of the impending war. And the old uncle, who was chairman of the reinsurance company with whom I worked all my working life, he quite firmly said, no, don't go to university, there's a war coming. He'd spent quite a lot of time himself in Germany. Come and learn about the business for as long as you're able to, and there'll be something to come back to, and you'll know something about it when you do.
Had you formed any sort of expectations about how the war might be conducted in this period of threat?
No, I don't think one had at all. Of course, one always had pictures of the first war, and one I think thought that was a pretty horrid way of going about things, and hoped it wouldn't be quite like that.
Had you heard about the First War from
Well, my father was a soldier in the First War. In fact, he'd been in the Boer War first, and then he'd spent a long time in India. And although he never actually spent any time on the Western Front in the trenches, he did take part in the Gallipoli landing. And jumping ahead a bit, he always said that the D-Day landing was an example of how it should have been done, and how the Gallipoli was the perfect example of chaos and muddle, and how it shouldn't have been done.
Looking back, do you think he's right about that?
I think he was pretty nearly right about that. Not that I had first-hand experience of Gallipoli, which of course I didn't. But
when you joined the 13th, 18th, just back from Dunkirk, what impression did you get of them, of their condition and the state of their morale and the equipment and so on?
I think their morale was splendid. I mean, I think they'd had a fairly successful time themselves in France in a reconnaissance role, with very little equipment, really, but they lost everything they had. But I think they were very bearish, really, about the situation. The morale was very good, I thought.
What about their physical condition?
Physical condition was fine. There was no no evidence of any physical or other I don't know what sort of evidence you thought there might have been. I mean, they're certainly well fed and looked very fit.
Did they need to take in many battle casualty replacements to make up the numbers, or had they brought most of their chaps back?
Most of them came back. Most of the chaps came back in different ways. Some minor wounds. My brother had minor wounds, and I think some others were similar there. But they very quickly all got together in Tidworth. But they hadn't got any equipment. I mean, they came back with nothing.
Was that soon put right?
Well, it took time. As far as I remember, we were sent to the first row. I think I've got my sequence of events right. We were sent up here in Essex to North Weald Aerodrome to defend North Weald Aerodrome itself from parachute attack, was there. And to the only equipment we had at this time were little standard motor car chassis with half an inch of boilerplate and about an inch of oak all round them on three sides. And what was the little, not a, the successor to the Lewis gun was called a
Bren gun?
Bren gun. And a Bren gun, which stuck out in the front. And they were vastly overweight for their braking system. and of course, driving at night with the very muted lights that one was allowed, there was always danger if you put your foot on the brake and nothing happened at all, and you just went straight into the ditch. And so Essex was littered with broken down, they were called beaverettes, and I mean they were useless really. I mean, you couldn't have done anything with them at all. But they, from a morale point of view, there was something.
Do you remember when you actually got them?
No, I don't really. They seemed to arrive in batches. And we were stationed at, squadrons were, some were, headquarters was in Epping, and then there was a squadron in Thaden Boys, which was my squadron, C squadron, and the other squadrons were dotted around. And of course there was no, in fact, parachute attack on North Weald at that time.
Did you have any alarms, any scares about parachute attack? Or
not about parachute attack that I remember. But of course, subsequently, Northfield was very heavily bombed, and they had to move out of the operations room, which I had worked in when I was in the searchlights. I had been in the operations room for several tours of duty, which was always very interesting.
How was that set up then when you were in there, attached to the searchlight unit?
Well, there was a liaison officer there who would pass on the information of incoming attacks to the searchlight headquarters to alert them. But that was really the role of the chap sitting there.
But, I mean, what was actually in the room? How was it laid out and furnished?
Oh, it was laid out with a great map. And girls, waffs, with, like croupiers, moving aircraft about on the map.
Sounds like it was laid out as it's shown in all the black and white war films.
That's right, about the exactly like that.
How large an area did it cover, the map?
I suppose the whole thing was about the size of this room.
This is a large room.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the operations room itself would have been about three times the size of this room, but there were galleries and all sorts of other interests, both municipal, the fire brigades and the various other ARP.
So this is part of the headquarters complex for the Air Defence of Great Britain?
Yes, for the sector that Northfield controlled. Mm-hmm. And it had its satellites at Martlesham and Hornchurch and around.
As I remember it, Hornchurch was a fighter station, wasn't it?
Yes, well, so was North Wheel.
And Martlesham also, I think they were all fighter stations. Well, was it dug in, this operations room?
No, it was well above ground. Yes.
It sounds like it would have been a natural target for...
And indeed it was, and was hit. And indeed, coming back on one of the patrols, we used to go out in these beaverettes to really show the flag and to get to know the countryside and where we might have to go if there was a flap. And coming back once, there's a certain point now where the M11 meets the road in Chelmsford, which is high and looks down more or less on Northfield. And I remember coming back there and seeing Northfield actually being bombed. And it was an absolute grandstand view of this. And the other thing we saw from Thaden Boys, which is high, was we saw the bombing of the docks. And you could see the flames of the east end of London quite clearly. Actually see the flames. It was an amazing sight, and one of the really heavy raids. And they were not all that much fun, actually.
I was going to ask you what sort of psychological impact seeing those air attacks had on you and on the soldiers, because it's a matter of controversy about whether they stiffened the resistance of the civil population or whether they did start to demoralise them as time went on.
I would definitely say they stiffened it. I think they made people bloody angry. And one of the roles that we had was, after these raids, to take I can't think of before. It was much of a morale boost to see a beaverette driving through the bombed, battered East End. But that's what they sent us to do.
Probably better than nothing.
Probably better than nothing, but...
When you were on this anti-airborne duty, were you part of an integrated defence plan which included the Home Guard and other regular
if
units?
If we were, I was quite unaware of it. I suppose we were, theoretically. But at that time, I have no recollection. I was very junior subaltern of whether what formation we were in at all. And then we were moved out further into Suffolk and north and east Essex at Gosfield was our headquarters. We still only had these beaverettes, and the whole sort of nonsense went on, and there was even more beaverettes in Essex ditches than ever before, and still, of course, no invasion. And we were really spending, if you like, time until they'd got some equipment for us. And that took place relatively soon after this, when we were sent up to Northamptonshire, the theory being to form the 9th Armoured Division. And there were three brigades dotted over Northamptonshire, up into down into Oxfordshire and up into the I suppose towards Cambridgeshire, whilst the idea being we were near the factories that were making the tanks and that the delivery would come through that way. And the 9th Armoured Division, under the generalship of a chap called Brockus Burrows, gradually took shape. And we then started doing large-scale exercises all over the country.
Do you think that there had been any beneficial training effects from driving the Beaverettes around the countryside? Had you been able to move tactically and practice the use of ground and tactical bounds and things
of
that sort?
Well, not really. You couldn't leave the road. Yeah. The moment you got off the road, you got stuck. It was all done on the roads. I suppose it taught one map reading. I think it did do that. And that, of course, was vital.
Were you a capable map reader before you joined the regiment?
One had had to read a map. And I never regarded myself as the best map reader. There were some people who were frankly good.
When you joined as a subaltern, what did they do with you when you arrived at the regiment with your certificate A and your experience in the Searchlight Battery? What was the first thing that you had to do on arrival?
Well, it's very hard to remember. There they had come back having had all the traumas of Dunkirk, with no equipment and a certain amount of chaps were there, and I was told to join the C Squadron, which was very coherent. They were all regular soldiers. They were, that I think made a huge difference.
I was going to ask you about the men, you know, and
made a huge difference.
You can length of service, and
I noticed it from the difference of the Territorial Army. Yes. Very much that these were professionals, particularly the officers, and I was given a troop to look after, but I mean, looking after a troop with nothing except themselves was they hadn't even got any clothes, or I mean, they hadn't had anything. And,
how did they receive you when you first arrived, freshly minted, with no experience of armour or regular army life? Did you get a good reception, or were they a bit quizzical at first?
Wasn't conscious of any criticism. I mean, I think they knew that one knew nothing, but then, of course, they knew nothing, but they didn't have anything.
But they had been in action.
They'd been in action.
In
there
Belgium
was no, I had no feelings of, you know, being an outsider for that reason at all.
What was their sort of average age, would you say, in your troop when you first took it over?
Older than me. I mean, I would have been just about 20, I suppose, then. I think most of them were under 30, probably.
What sort of part of the country did they come from? Were they all from one area?
No, they
area?
Came from just about everywhere. And they're widely dispersed. And a lot of Cockneys and a lot of a certain amount of West Country people. And North Country, Yorkshiremen. There were quite a few Yorkshiremen.
It sounds like a very broad mixture.
Very broad mixture.
Did they all get on all right?
I thought so. I thought so. I thought that side of it was very impressive.